This episode contains strong language and depictions of violence that may be triggering to some listeners. Please be advised.
I remember it was the Jabriya had been kidnapped, the Kuwaiti airliner, huh? And I was covering that story, and Yasser Arafat was negotiating, you know, the releasing the plane. And of course, as a Reuters reporter, I was taking pictures. There was a press conference and I was taking pictures, and we used to take the picture, go develop it. And so I took 3-4 pictures. The contrast wasn't right. So I just put them in my donkey bag, and, you know, and then I wired the picture and I put the pictures in my bag in the zipper in the back. I don't know, 7-8 months later, I go to Beirut and I was with Aline, and Abu Musa had taken over some of the camps. It was the Abu Musa Fatah war clashes, whatever you want to call it. And so here we're going into the camp, very, you know, dandily. I think we were going to film children in schools or something really not very dangerous or anything. So we're strolling in, and the guy checks us at the entrance of the camp, opens the zipper of my donkey bag, and pulls out 3 Yasser Arafat portraits this big. And Aline gives me one look and looks at the guy. And 3 minutes later, she said, "Jan, I have something to do in the office. I have to leave." And I'm like standing there, like I can't open my mouth. It's like, are you crazy? You're going to leave me here alone? Yeah. She goes. And the guy looks at me and he says, "Arafatiya inti." And I'm like, "La Arafatiya wala ghair Arafatiya, ana sahafiya." It's like, I'm not a Arafatist or not, like, I'm nothing, I'm just a journalist. Come with me. And they take me and they put me in this little classroom, a children's classroom. The chairs were really small and I was fat, huh? So I was sitting there, and another guy came with their guns and everything. You know, the militias, like, they like looking dangerous, and they did look dangerous, I have to admit. And they sat on the teacher's desk and sat me in this kindergarten table of a child, and I'm sitting there, and they look at me and they're discussing amongst themselves, "So what do we do with her?" And they had all these hypotheses. Okay, who, she works for Reuters, who cares? Is she an important person? How do you check if she's an important person? No, she's Egyptian. So do we lock her up there? No, it's going to be, who's going to feed her? Who's going to... So they were discussing my fate right there in front of me, and I couldn't open my mouth. And finally, one of them said, "You know what? Easy is just knock her off." Okay, they agreed to knock me off. And I was really scared, okay? And out of nowhere, the door opens and Aline arrives with one of their chiefs. And the guy tells them, "Are you crazy? You're going to knock off a journalist of an international? Get out of here, the two of you." And Aline grabs me and we bloody run out like, you don't know, you run like you've never ran before. And so I always say Aline Manoukian certainly saved my life. And while I was sitting in that little classroom, one of my obsessions, like, how did she just leave me like this? But you see, you were asking earlier about survival, and I think that's what it is. It took one look at what was happening, and she understood that if we're going to get out of this mess, I need to move now. And I think we all kind of acquired that sense of now. It's not about thinking, it's about instinct. Go.
Bujur Barajni was under siege by the Amal militia. And after 3 or 4 months, there was starvation in the camp. So, and there was coverage of that starvation. You could hear rumors that the Palestinian refugees were having to slaughter cats and dogs to survive. They had no medicines, etc., etc. And on Fridays, they'd allow the women to go out and shop in Sabra. And on their way back, they would snipe at them. And when the 19th woman was killed, I said, that's it. We have to go in. And I remember I got in touch with someone at the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And I said, I want to go. And he said, you know, on your own, but I'll make arrangements for you to sleep in the offices of the hospital.
My first assignment actually was to go into the camp. It was the camp war. And we had contacts inside the camp, you know, Palestinians inside the camp, and they arranged how to get in. We were like 3 or 4 journalists. I can't remember, but there were some, one from Reuters, me and others. So we sneaked into Brzezelbrzeźni, basically, to see, to describe the situation inside under the siege, because they were saying that there was famine, because no goods were going into the camp. And, you know, children were without milk and they were eating cats and dogs, you know, the whole thing.
I dressed up in shabby clothes, lined up with the women on Friday as they were going back in, you know, carrying eggs and oil, and I helped them carry. And of course, I had notebooks. So I chose notebooks that had little girls and flowers on them. My editors didn't want to let me go at first. And I said, look, one of your correspondents left a bulletproof vest. So I wore that, and I had a very bad cold at the time. And I had the notebooks with me, and one of the ML women who searched me at the entrance said, what are these notebooks for? I told her, they're for my niece. She likes to draw. I mean, I kind of winged my way in. And sure enough, the women were shot at. And it was a pretty hairy thing. I mean, some of the women, after entering, they were so scared they'd start throwing up. And I latched on to a couple of little girls and I said, take me to the Shifa hospital.
It was the first time ever I entered a Palestinian camp. I was shocked. It was really, I didn't imagine there was something like that in Lebanon. They were burying their dead near the houses and all that.
I spent 24 hours in the camp, taking notes, debriefing foreign doctors and nurses, and talking to the refugee women and one of the Dutch nurses had taken rolls and rolls of film, of pictures. I put them in my bulletproof vest. Every other person I saw was on crutches. There were so many people with severed legs. It was really a very dark time for these poor people. And yet they were brave in some way. Two little girls who I got to meet interview. They were often sent outside the camp. They would go to the southern periphery and jump from maybe several meters and meet up with people on the outside who would give them medication and anesthesia and things that they needed in the camp. And they would come back and jump in. And I remember it was cold because I was wearing a sweater. So it must have been in the winter or the spring. I can't remember. How the women tried to keep their kids and their menfolk alive by being resourceful, by cooking weeds, whatever they could find. And I wrote my story.
I was traumatized, actually, when I saw this. When I went out, I went to the office to write my story. I couldn't write. They gave me mazahir. And that was the big first adventures I had. in reporting. It was like le baptême.
...1976 was Tel Azata, the camp that had been besieged for several months. And the conditions in there were really terrible. It was completely surrounded by the Christian forces, who were having quite an easy time. It became a bit of a joke that they'd come up, do a few hours shooting at the Palestinians, then go off to the beach. And it was a bit of a luxury war for them, but inside the camp was terrible. There was an agreement brokered, as far as I remember, by an Egyptian mediator called Kholi, whereby the Palestinian fighters would pull out, and they did. They withdrew up into the mountains, and then the civilians would be evacuated to West Beirut. And what happened is the Palestinian fighters withdrew, and the Phalangists and other forces went in and massacred big time. So I went in shortly after that, and I think I was the first who went in the day after it actually fallen. And I was taken in by a student from the NLP, the Ahrar, you know, Shamoun's people, who was actually a student who was studying in Italy, and he seemed like a very nice chap, but he said he'd killed about 50 or 60 people the day before. Well, if you know anything about military stuff, one guy killing 50 or 60 people, it's a massacre, it's not a fight, you know, especially if people are defending an area they know. But to get there, of course, you had to go across Jisrat Pasha. And it, obviously what was happening is that, you know, families and people, you know, people from the camp were being trucked out. And as they were being trucked out, anybody with a gun over there who didn't like the look of somebody on the truck would just say, get down and kill them at the roadside. So as I went across the bridge of Jisrat Pasha to get to Tel Azata, there were, I can't remember, was it two or three bodies lying on the Rasif, on the pavement just beside the parapet of the bridge. And I thought, oh dear. Anyway, we got to camp, and I'll get into the camp in a minute, but on the way back, just to finish that story, I noticed the bodies had gone. So I thought the obvious thing is somebody had thrown them over the parapet. So I got out and looked over the parapet and saw the most horrible sight you can imagine, which was the local butchers had been throwing the offal, the guts of their animals that they killed there. So it was a mound of offal, but it had human bodies sticking out of it. So you had arms, legs, heads sticking out of this mound of stinking offal. It's about the most disgusting thing you can imagine. So that's what happened to those guys. Anyway, at the camp, we parked in a kind of parking lot or vacant lot just beside the entrance of the camp. And as I got out, I thought I was standing on some rags, you know, it's just some bits of cloth. But in fact, I was standing on a body that had been crushed into the, it had just been treated like a dead rat. It was just become part of the parking lot. I was actually standing on a dead body, but it was just so crushed that I thought it was just some old bits of rag. On the way into the camp, there was another body that was lying half on the road, half on the pavement, and people were just driving across the bottom half as though it was a rat, you know. Inside the camp, there were just horrible scenes. I mean, just bodies everywhere. There was an old man whose head had been crushed like an eggshell. Just somebody had taken a gun and just smashed in the top of his head. So it was just sort of completely smashed. There was a pregnant woman who'd been disemboweled. There was somebody who was actually in a coffin, and the coffin had just been sort of thrown open. So it was sort of a body splayed there. Just sort of dead people everywhere. So that was pretty traumatic, but I found that, you know, in my whole career, I've seen lots of stuff like that, and you tend to become like a camera. You see it, but it doesn't necessarily sort of sink into you. Maybe it has a long-term cumulative traumatic effect, but I find in general that you can somehow divorce yourself from it if you're, you know, an observer, as it were. And as I say, maybe it does affect you, but I didn't have sort of classic trauma symptoms like waking up at night sweating and having dreams and flashbacks and all this stuff. I've never had that. I don't say that my work hasn't affected my psyche, because it has in ways, but I think it's more the stress and the pressure than the actual traumatic things that I've witnessed, you know, which I somehow seem to be able to process, you know. This is the extraordinary thing about war. It turns normal people into monsters. I think it sort of completely changes the normal rules, you know. In war, people rape and they kill. And I think for them, in a way, part of them becomes divorced from the other part, and they do things that normally they would also regard as monstrous. I mean, this guy was a student studying in Italy, and he seemed like a nice guy, you know. But when it comes to war, people get fired up on, sometimes on drugs, but also on adrenaline and hatred. You know, there's a lot of hatred was focused on Telizzata. I mean, people were doing things like dragging corpses behind, I didn't see this myself, but dragging corpses behind their cars as they drove along, getting a skull and making a hole in it and putting on the antenna of their car and things like this. These kind of barbaric things were happening, you know. you know, people are capable of atrocities, you know, and yet in other ways they're normal human beings. But war does this strange thing to people. It makes, as I say, it turns some people into monsters. It's a strange phenomenon, war.
I got an assignment to work for Newsweek. So all of a sudden, I'm covering the 82 war for Newsweek. On the second or the third day of the war, I went with my best friend, a French woman, and we took a taxi down to the south because we wanted to see. We heard the Israelis had crossed over the border and we were bombing, and we wanted to see how far they'd gotten. So we went south of the city and we got as far as Gier, and the town was completely deserted. The driver said, "I'm not going any further. We have no idea where the Israelis are. They're coming this way and I'm going to park here." So we said, "All right, just park here. We're going to go take some pictures and we'll be back." So we walked down the road a little bit in GA and we found a Palestinian camp that had been abandoned and had been hit by like a rocket attack by helicopters. And so there was equipment lying around and a fire burning and things upside down. Not really that exciting, but to me it was exciting. I didn't have really the ability at that time to really judge, like, when something was, you know, interesting, mildly interesting, or very interesting. So I'm photographing it and photographing it. My friends say, "Okay, that's enough. We're going back to the car." So I said, "Okay, I just, like, give me a couple more minutes." And so I'm alone and I'm taking pictures of this burning camp, and I hear, "Sherpa, Sherpa, Sherpa." And just the whole place starts exploding around me. So I pick up my stuff and I start running back towards the car, which isn't too far, like maybe 300 meters away. And I'm running down the road and there's nobody there. The whole town is abandoned and bombs are exploding. And there was a guerrilla, a Palestinian guy from Democratia. And he said, "Hey, did you see a taxi? It was parked here." And he said, "Yeah, it left. It went that way." And he pointed to Beirut. And I said, "Yeah, did you see like any photographers?" And they said, "Yeah, they jumped in a Jeep and they also left." So I said, "Okay, like how far are the Israelis?" And he said, "Oh, they're like 2 kilometers from here." I said, "Really?" I said, "Okay, where's your Jeep?" And he said, "We don't have a Jeep." I said, "What do you mean you have a Jeep?" He said, come with me. So he took me under a little grove of trees and there's like 5 guys and they're sitting there like it's, you know, vacation time, drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, you know, like playing with their guns. And I go, "Okay, there's like 6 of you guys. I estimate that there's 20,000 Israelis coming up the road. Like, you know, where are the other guys?" And they said, "No, it's just us." I said, "And you don't have a Jeep?" I said, "No." I said, "What are you going to do?" And they said, "We're going to fight them." And I thought to myself, "Oh my God." Then it's like time for a quick decision. Like, if I stay with these guys and photograph like the last stand of these Palestinians, like Pulitzer Prize maybe. Then I thought, "You're gonna be dead. There's like no way." So I like finished my tea, tried not to be too nervous, finished my cigarette, and I said, "Okay guys, you know, you got to kalaf Alfie, all of you, you know, you're all heroes. You know? I'll see you later." So I went and I tried to find some shelter. And I was down in a ditch for a while, and the whole world is like blowing up around me. And you had these odd thoughts in your mind. And I thought, if one of these shells hits me, I'm going to burn up and no one's ever going to find my body. And I thought, oh, that's like why soldiers wear dog tags. It's because after you get blown up by a shell, at least there's your dog tag left. But I don't have one of those. And that idea was very upsetting to me, that no one would ever find me. So I went banging on the doors of the houses, and they were all locked, and there was no one there. But in one house, there was people inside. I could hear people shouting. But they wouldn't open the door. They wouldn't open the door. They wouldn't open the door. But I kept banging, and finally they did. And there was an old Lebanese man named Gibran, and he was blind. And that's why he couldn't leave. And then with him was a whole family from Ain al-Halwi, who were like the poorest of the poor refugees, who were like too poor for a donkey cart. So that's why they were there. So we all got down on the ground, and I opened up all the doors and windows. And pretty soon we could hear like a battle outside. And the battle stopped very quickly. And then we hear tanks going by. And then we hear... And the house was shaking. And I thought, oh shit, they're blowing up all the houses as they go by. And then they started shooting machine guns into the house. And there's like stuff flying everywhere. And I remember having read that the Israelis drop leaflets that if there's no terrorists in the house, that you should wave a white flag. So I took off the coat from Gibran. He had this white smoking jacket. I wrapped it around his cane, and I went to the window, and I was like waving it out of the window. And the women, the refugee women, were all like screaming, "Der Yassin, Der Yassin!" They were like certain we were all going to get lined up and shot, and they were like tearing at me like to get away from the window. But then I heard like screaming outside, and I looked outside, and there's two Israeli soldiers standing there. And I came out with my cameras over my head, shouting like, "Newsweek magazine, Newsweek magazine." And they're shouting at me, but they're shouting in Hebrew. They didn't speak English. They didn't. And behind them is a parade of tanks, like tanks and tanks and tanks and tanks, and soldiers walking and helicopters overhead. And I looked down the road, and you could see a parade of like Israeli tanks and soldiers as far as you could see, stretching all the way, like as far as you could see. Anyway, so they take me, like with my hands over my head, down to the road, and an Israeli command car comes up. And they turn me over to the officer there, and the officer says, I said, "Listen, I'm a journalist, I'm with Newsweek, blah, 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 blah." And he says, "Listen, I don't have time to deal with you right now. We're fighting a war. You know, I'll deal with you later." And he drives off. And so I'm just standing there. The other two guys lost interest. So they, you know, went walking down the road with the rest of their unit. And I'm standing there, just sort of dumbstruck, shell-shocked. And the Israeli troops that are walking by start waving at me. And I realized, these idiots think I came with them. They have no idea who I am. So I sort of waved back, and I took a picture and waited for somebody to shout. Nobody shouted. I took another picture. Nobody shouted. And I started like walking with the guys. And they're acting very friendly to me. They just assume that I'm like an American reporter that came with them. And as they go down the road, they're blowing up every house that they pass and shooting anything in sight on both sides of the road. And I'm like photographing all this. And we walk up the road, I guess, a couple kilometers. And there's a big villa that belongs to President Shamoun. And they storm the villa, they take it over, and they make it into their command headquarters. And they keep me there for like 3 days with them. And it was very weird. You know, all of a sudden I'm with like these guys. And they're actually nice to me. They're not, you know, abusing me or anything. And at night we get attacked by the Palestinians. That was the craziest thing. Like Katyusha rockets fly over our heads and land in the ocean. And I'm thinking, oh boy, it's going to look really bad if I die with these guys. Like, try to explain that one. Anyway, after a few days, I had taken all this photograph. A jeep comes for me, and they say, "The commander wants to see you." So they stick me in a jeep. And before I go up there, I take all the film that I can, the most important film, and I hide it in my underwear. And then I have all of this other film on me, in my jacket and my cameras. And they drive me up to the top of the hill that overlooks Damour. and the Israelis have set up their command post, and they march me inside this tent. And there's an officer. I don't know what rank he was sitting there. And I say, listen, I'm an American news reporter. I come from Beirut, covering the war for Newsweek, blah, 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 blah. And he just doesn't listen to anything he says. He opens up my jackets, exposes every roll of film that he can find, makes me open my cameras, exposes all the film. And he says, listen, this is what we're going to do. You live in Beirut, which is the home of terrorists, rats. And if you decide that you want to live with these terrorist rats, then that's your choice. And that's where you want to be. So this is what we're going to do. This jeep is going to drive you back down. We're going to go to our front line and you can walk back to them. I said, what do you mean? If I walk from your front line into their front lines, you know, they're going to shoot me down. I said, hey, these are your people. Get out of here. And he kicked me out of the tent. And I went and I was sitting and I was thinking, this is an execution. He's like trying to execute me without executing me. And my mind is racing. I'm trying to think of what to do. And this Israeli soldier comes up. But this guy is sort of older and bald and has a couple of nice cameras. And he says, who are you? And I tell him, who do you work for? Newsweek. What agency do you have? Agence Gamma. Who do you know at Newsweek? Who's the photo editor? Who's the sub-photo editor? Blah, 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 blah. And then he says, wait right here. I guess I answered the questions to his satisfaction. It turns out this guy is Shlomo Arad, who was like the top Newsweek photographer in Israel, who was assigned by the same people who assigned me, but to cover the war from Tel Aviv. And he came out of the tent and he said, listen, I arranged for you to get on a helicopter with the wounded. Here's 100 shekels. When you get to Israel, you know, use this to make a telephone call to the Newsweek bureau. And so I said, okay. I had no idea what 100 shekels was. And he said, you know, later he told me, you know, that's the only time I ever begged in my life. I begged this guy not to, like, execute you. So they put me on this helicopter with all these wounded people. And it goes up into the air and out over the ocean like a motorcycle. From the air, you could see all of Lebanon burning, from the border to Beirut, just plumes of smoke everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. And they were bombing Damour at that point, softening it up. It goes out over the ocean, flies for, it seemed like 2 minutes, 5 minutes, and it banks the other way. I look down and it looks like there's Southern California down there. There's like really nice streets, ranch style houses with backyards, people mowing lawns. And it flies to Batula Air Base, which is right on their northern border. And the helicopter lands. And remember, I have like all this footage in my underwear that nobody's seen. And they're carrying the wounded off the helicopter. And I could see that the gate to the base was like within eyesight. So I got off the base and I just started looking at my feet and just walking towards the gate. And I walked right out of the gate. And I realized they check you when you walk onto a military base. They don't check you when you leave. And so here I am in Israel. I have no idea what is up or down in Israel. I knew I wanted to go to Jerusalem. And I had read somewhere that there, instead of putting out their thumb when they hitchhike, they put out their index finger. So I put my index finger out. And this car stops, and I'm like, you gotta imagine, you know, my pants are dirty and ripped. You know, I have like been out in the field for 3 or 4 days. I'm all fucked up. And I get in the taxi, and the guy starts yelling at me in Hebrew. And I go, oh, why is he yelling at me? Why is this guy yelling at me? He knows what's up. And then I realized he was yelling at me because I was driving without a seatbelt on, and he was saying it's really dangerous, and I should have a seatbelt. So anyway, long story short, I make my way to the Newsweek office. I turn over the film to them. The film shows these people inside of the house screaming with me. They show the tanks blowing up houses. And I had like 3 rows of color film and I think 1 or 2 of black and white. So I gave them all the color film because Newsweek doesn't operate in black and white. And I gave them the film and they took away my assignment. They sent the film, they said they did to Newsweek. When the magazine came out the next week, they carried my pictures, but they carried pictures that I had taken earlier in the day of our guys shooting at them, and none of those pictures. And they were never, ever, ever seen again. And they took away my assignment, which was worst of all. And I thought, you know, I mean, now I realize, if this was to happen today, and like a Newsweek photographer would, in the course of carrying out his assignment, photograph, you know, civilians trapped under gunfire, all this sort of stuff, go from one side to the other, deliver the film, you know, to the magazine, they would get an award. You know, they would at least get a story in the magazine about them. I got fired. And that's why I sort of started to realize that, you know, journalism is a wonderful thing. Journalism is my life. It's my religion. But unless you're wise, you can be working counter to the purpose that you're working. And I also came to feel that way about my early photographs of Lebanon. They show the terror of war and all that sort of thing, but they don't show anything about why I love this place. You know, they don't show anything about like the laughter, you know, or the spirit of our people, you know, they don't, it's so reductionist. I mean, there is a place for that kind of photography, but at that time, without other news outlets, without other media outlets, that's all people saw. And that's why people in the first world find it hard to sympathize with people in, you know, the less developed countries, because they never see them or learn much about them unless it's a time of disaster. And there's compassion fatigue. And plus that, the magazine story that Newsweek ran with these photographs was Israel's terrible swift sword, which is an allusion to a song, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, where God smites evil people with his terrible swift sword. So they were framing the invasion as, you know, good versus evil, with even a little bit of sort of divinity thrown in, you know. So, yeah, that was eye-awakening. But I did make it back to Beirut, but it wasn't thanks to Newsweek. I went to, I guess it was Tel Aviv or Haifa, and I caught a boat to Cyprus, and then from Cyprus, caught a boat to Junieh. And by the time I got back here, Ras Beirut was completely surrounded, so I had to run the blockade, the Israeli blockade, to get back into West Beirut. And I got back here like 2 weeks after I had left home that morning, and everybody thought I was dead. And when I went to my room, I said, like, where's my stuff? Where's my sleeping bag? And they said, oh, well, when you didn't come back, we thought you were dead, so we, like, everyone took what they wanted.
Then you had Taif, and I got to cover that. Nobody knew it was going to take 5 weeks. We basically left with the group of deputies, Lebanese parliamentarians who hadn't met. Basically, we covered the talks, and we got to meet Saud al-Faisal and the king, and the Syrians were there. The Syrians, there were two guys from Abdel Halim Khaddam's office, was foreign minister. Hariri was there in a Galabia, you know, wandering through the palaces he had built, very pleased with himself because he had helped kind of grandfather this agreement with the help of the Americans and the Saudis. And it was hopeful and shameful at the same time, because they paid everybody off. Even the Lebanese journalists lined up to be paid by the Saudis. They each got $5,000. It was really shameful. And all the warlords and all these geriatric deputies who hadn't done a thing for their country made out like bandits.
It does come back in your dreams. These clicks come back in your dreams, but they don't filter into your daily life. You see the world through a camera and you're somehow protected.
The TV guys or the cameramen would go and film images, really bloody images, the raw Russians. So we would watch them to be able to describe in writing. Once I was writing And suddenly I broke down and I started crying and shivering. And I said, I mean, we have been describing blood and death and blood and killing for so long. I just broke down. No, خلاص, too much. هلا بيعملوا له mental health follow up. At the time, we didn't have mental health follow up. They used to give us those called R&R, rest and recreation. They would send us for a week on R&R outside Lebanon just to rest and recharge our batteries. Yeah.
We've all had a difficult time finding the transition point from that stage of your life and your career. And how do you survive economically as a war photographer when there's no more war? You know, how do you find your sanity?
Correspondents who would come and visit intermittently would mockingly say, Nora's the happiest person in Beirut, because I was always trying to be positive, always trying to stay ahead of the game. But that doesn't mean that you don't pay for it later. It catches up with you much, much later. 2008, if you remember, they had this real estate crash, the economic crash, and they were letting a lot of people go. Every 4 months, they'd put out a buyout package that you could choose to take if you wanted. And so I took one of the buyouts, which was one of the best buyouts they offered. You had 45 days to make up your mind, and I regretted it later, but I made up my mind. I was really tired. And that's when I sensed that all the trauma of the wars I had covered, that I was actually burnt out. I was really, I had never really come to terms. You know, you'd say to yourself, okay, I'm gonna go see a therapist. And they'd say, it's impossible, you don't have PTSD, you are successful. Whereas on the inside, I felt it. You know, there were days that were very difficult for me to just kind of get up and go to work. And health-wise, I had suffered. I felt that I had kind of ended my career early. There was this other instinct of survival, kind of catching up with yourself.
It really shook up my worldview. It really shook up my worldview. I became much more anti-violence than I was before. And that was the other big revelation for me. You know, it's easy to romanticize war. And when I got here, actually, I remember like a few times being like pinned down by gunfire and like really not thinking I wasn't going to get out of this situation alive. And then and thinking, you know, this is what war is like. It's not, there's no soundtrack. I kept waiting for the music, you know, because even in the most horrible war film, there's always stirring music that lifts your spirits or sad music. This is, war is about as, you know, as romantic as a car accident. Like, there's nothing lovely to say about someone's head going through the windshield, you know. We don't romanticize that. But, you know, war gets romanticized.
Even before it all started, there was an old thing, Le Ralub, Le Marloub, if you can pronounce all these rhymes, meaning, you know, no victor, no vanquished. Nobody wins. And that, if they'd sort of acted on that from the beginning, we'd have had a lot less trouble. But it took all that pain to come to the same conclusion after trying everything, bringing in Israelis, Americans, Syrians, Palestinians, Arab League, God knows what. Who won? Nobody. Everybody lost. And that's what happens, you know. And I think, and I hope, that has sunk into the DNA, you know.
A lot of people talk about absurdity. I disagree. You could see it as absurdity, but I really, really honestly think, I think of when all this was happening. We're talking about the late 70s and the early 80s, let's say until the end of the 80s, we're talking about a moment of complete shift in world order. Huh? And very much so, Lebanon was at this crossroad of the shifting balances. So I don't think there was anything absurd about it. There was a lot of fighting over trying to stop the death of a certain vision of the world. And I think that is what was conquered. I think that space of believing in a post-colonial justice died in Lebanon. It might sound like a grand statement, but very much so. Huh? Because, and it's not just connected to the Palestinians, let's be honest, the departure of the Palestinians in 82, no matter how much it remains alive, the Palestinian cause as such remains alive on a drip. It died with the departure of that boat, and with it all the solidarity notions of all different camps. All these notions of post-colonial solidarities died in Lebanon. Huh? All the training, I mean, you even had the Japanese Red Army at some point training in Lebanon. So it's not a banal, absurd space, nor a banal, absurd moment. I just wanted to underpin that all the absurdity comes from a very not absurd route.
So when the explosion happened, it's remarkable how different my reaction was. Not my reaction, but my actions. My reaction was exactly the same. My reactions were different. You know, it's funny, I've been talking about this war for so long, and like, the first thing that makes me cry is the explosion. I'm really glad this is not being filmed. It went from being the homeland of my parents, you know, that I'm visiting, to my city, my place. Yeah, so the day of the explosion, I was sitting at my desk, and my desk is by a large plate glass window, and I feel this little earthquake. And I get up from my desk, and I walk 3 paces, and I turn to my wife. She looks at me, and the next thing I know, I run to the closet. I don't shoot every day anymore, so my camera's in a closet in a camera bag. I'm like madly digging away through it. I find the camera and I snap like 2 or 3 pictures, which came out blurry because I couldn't even like look at the shutter speed or anything. And I realized at this stage of my life, like, it's not exactly my job, you know? It's not exactly my job to leave my family behind. So next time we're invaded by the Israelis, I often ask myself, what are you gonna do? I mean, it's next time, right? You guys made me cry, you prick motherfuckers, both of you.
You are listening to Ma'bar, a season on journalism during the Lebanese Civil War. We would like to thank each and every journalist and photographer for sharing their stories with us and being a part of Ma'bar. If you enjoy our content, please subscribe to our channel and support us on Patreon.